If you could have a conversation with anyone in history, what would you ask them?
Hello, General Washington. Good day, Miss Tubman.
I had to know, so I decided, let's give him a call.
Welcome to the Calling History Podcast.
Welcome back to part two of Dr. Joseph Warren. In this episode, you're going to hear about Warren's experience attending to those just murdered at the Boston Massacre and his true feelings about reconciling with Great Britain.
This makes so much sense. I've never heard it put this way. And you use the word bargaining chips, and as you are describing this time when you were in your teens, and you're talking about how they would just come over and grab some men for the French Indian War and say, okay, great, now go expand our territory.
Well, the year itself is called the Seven Years' War, but it's mainly called the French Indian War here because we are differentiating, of course, between what we are as British colonists and the British Army versus the French, who were the main antagonists, as well as the Indians, mainly the Six Nations of Iroquois that teamed up with them, essentially, and allied themselves together. So it's mainly called the Seven Years' War, and I think incorrectly speaking, it should be called the Seven Years' War. But I understand that even in more recent years, I only hear it's called the French and Indian War, but I believe that may be a North American influence in terms of recording the history of it.
Well, the reason I bring that up, when you were talking about everybody is a bargaining chip now, the way that you're describing this, and, you know, we talked about the British seeing the colonists as, they're not British citizens, they're colonists. The people in America, it appears to me that British looks at them almost like a barrel of rice or corn, and not really of any other value than just when they need some, they reach in and they scoop up whatever they need and they leave. If they need troops, they scoop up some troops and they take them and send them wherever they need them. If they need money, they scoop some up. But that's the only thing that they look at them as. They're just, the colonists are just a resource for the British. Is that the way it feels?
For several reasons, yes. I mean, for example, so how can I put this without ruffling too many feathers of any Tories that may hear this? Let's say, for example, John Hancock, my dear friend, who attended the coronation of King George III. You wouldn't know that unless we told you. That's if that hints at the type of connotation towards the colonists. It's not that, you know, no one's going to mention in the papers, oh, yes, and the Honorable John Hancock Esquire, the young heir from Massachusetts Bay, was also in attendance. They're not going to name John Hancock amongst the attendees. They're going to name someone from the House of Commons or the House of Lords or someone from the ministry or someone else who's related to King George III. They're not going to mention some colonist who happened to be there. It just so happened that colonist probably has more money than many of them. But it doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. That is definitely the connotation. And that feeling of feeling less than a British citizen is tied to what we were bringing up against the case of writs of assistance. Now, the writs of assistance gives a customs official the right to say, enter my home and say, this is all contraband. You obtained all of this via the black market, via nefarious means. This is all now property of the crown. And they could take all of my possessions if they had reasonable doubt.
Under the writ of assistance, they can just walk in, they see something that they like, and they're like, I really like that. So they must have got this from the black market, and so now I'm going to take it, and they can just walk out with it. That's what you're saying?
How did you get French Madeira wine? You must have gotten that through a smuggler. There's no way. We don't allow that through the British trade. That was part of the issues when John Hancock had his ship seized in 1768. It's these things that are happening because they are able to go in, these customs officials, under writs of assistance, and deem what is not my property because I am a colonist. And if this is not something that is a regular item in British trade, it could immediately be questioned. Like, say, if someone were to import something from the Far East in China, right? If you import its porcelains or types of silk, etc., then, okay, well, that's not something that we normally see. I like that. Maybe you didn't get that by morally righteous means. We're going to take it. But the problem with all of this is that the customs official, once that those items sell, they keep two-thirds of the profit from seizing my property. How is that fair at all? Now, mind you, I have never been subjected to the case of risk of assistance, and by and large, those have been some of the more lesser matters in more recent years. However, what sparked all of this, as we saw that new acts were being passed that encroached on our dignity, and as we move forward, then we would have this grievance dealt with somehow, and then some other act would take its place. Say, so case of risk of assistance, I think, is right in line in right around early 1760s. So we look at that and say, okay, well, now the next thing, the Stamp Act of 1765. Now we have the Townshend Act of 1768. Now we move forward, and then all of a sudden, the colonists are angry, so they threw a bunch of tea into a harbor, and now we have to pay for the bill. Now we're going to pass the Boston Port Act. Now we're going to shut down the whole thing. And now you're going to have a military governor, and now this. And they never listened to the fact that we want free trade and self-governance, and we were able to serve our king and our country without being monopolized and ridiculed and deemed less than all the time. And that is something that is certainly called on deaf ears.
Just a little respect is what you're asking for. So with what you're describing, how is it even possible that there are any British loyalists?
Well, some have families who are very well connected to their mother country. Some of them that live here in Massachusetts Bay are also considered British citizens. Some people also are what you would call loyalists or Tories because of fear. They fear that they will lose business, they will lose friends, they will lose family if they make that hard decision. And unfortunately for myself, I lost many a friend that considered themselves a loyalist to the crown or a Tory because of my complete appall and just frustration with what happened during the Boston Massacre and several of the instances before that and the several grievances that we had. As I became more vocal and as I became more inspired to help people and became more confident in especially and who I was as a young man, I think people didn't appreciate that I was willing to be partisan in some respects. Now, there are certain things, despite all of the recent rhetoric and despite all of these battles that unfortunately have occurred here in Massachusetts Bay, there are things that Tories and loyalists believe that Americans or so-called Whigs also believe. Whigs and Tories alike both believe that healthcare, that the basic necessity of life and the basic health of life is necessary for all people. And it's something that's not talked about that we're able to agree upon. And there are ways that we can grow and increase in strength together. But like I said, I feel that these recent battles and these recent grievances have taken us far too far. And I don't think that any of the connections that we have will last if this continues.
Well, I'm going to give you some bad news. And I promised I wasn't going to tell you anything about the future because I don't want to change it because your life matters, sir. But I am going to tell you that the debate on healthcare, it never ends. So I think you're right.
It should be right.
I expected that you would feel that way. But there's a lot of good that happens. But we're still trying to figure that one out. I mean, people have it.
Well, if someone is sick, they should be cared for. I don't see how hard that is. I don't know if you know this about me at all, but from 1769 to 1772, I was the public health care servant in Boston. And partially this enterprise that myself and other local doctors carried out, we would serve for 3 or so years as the public health servant. So if anything happened in the town of Boston or wherever you were stationed, then you would be the responder to any sort of injuries or sicknesses that were occurring. Quite the oddity, I should say, that because of my position, I was there during the Boston Massacre and saw those peoples and saw the wretchedness that occurred, and it influenced me in so many ways. So but my service to all peoples, it doesn't matter if you are, say, a gentleman or even the enslaved. I believe that all people should be healthy, and hopefully someday we can proceed and break the chain that some people are still wearing, despite this form of equality that we've been able to achieve in my time. But I will say it is quite disappointing to hear that your time hasn't figured it out yet.
Well, there are countries that have sort of figured it out, and I do believe that this does get figured out, but I will tell you that I think that you've hit the nail right on the head when you say, if somebody's sick and they need help, you help them. It seems so obvious, and you know why it seems so obvious for you and not for everybody is because you're a doctor. First and foremost, I mean, yeah, and as a doctor, you're around people that need help all the time, and you would certainly have empathy for anybody that is suffering, whereas, you know, people, if they're not, if they don't have their hands on something, I think it's difficult for them to have empathy. I mean, you look at the battle that just happened a few months ago. I mean, anybody that would get shot by a musket ball would understand that shooting a musket ball at somebody probably isn't a good idea, but until you feel it, you don't have empathy. If everybody got shot once, there'd be no war. You know, if everybody had to be a doctor for a week, everybody would have health care, I'm guessing.
Well, so the unfortunate thing about the April 19th events is because of the way that the fighting had to be carried out, we didn't necessarily have a field hospital set up for the wounded and sick. And unfortunately, on both sides of the conflict, many of men died on the field of battle who probably had been saved. We are working on that in our camp to make sure that soldiers from both sides of the conflict can be tended to appropriately and immediately, or at least as early as possible, to avoid the most unfortunate results of all, which is death. Yes, it's very hard to describe the brutality of what can be caused by ammunition and the warfare that we have in our time.
Yeah.
So as I look at this device, which is technologically advanced, sure that you probably have some advanced weaponry now that is probably even more scary than firing a musket ball through a Philadelphia long rifle at somebody. But it's something that I think needs to be looked at, and maybe not only just celebrate the war aspect of it or the victories, but also look at the defeats. We learn so much through failure, and I think our failure to not be able to reconcile before things get to how they are here now, I think, is the greatest loss in humanity. Hopefully, your time learns what my time seems to can't. And I hope this conflict does end soon. But if I am correct in what I've been told and what I believe our conflict now will be going on for quite some time. Whenever it ends, I hope that we can only redeem our country until the glorious work is done.
Unfortunately, I hate to say this, but I think as long as there is a situation where there are people that want things and there are people that don't have things and there are people that have more than others, which it is hard to make everything fair, there'll always be war in some format, that's for sure. Let me just go back to the Boston Massacre for a second. You were actually there the day that the guns were fired, right?
So I was at my home, which is off of Hanover Street in Boston, which I hope to see again soon. We were actually, most of the town was alarmed because we had set off the bells, which is usually reserved in terms of there's a fire. So the bells were rang to alarm the town. And as most of us made our way through the town square, just down the ways from the old state house, we came upon some of the victims, which were spread out along King Street by the state house. Crispus Attucks was actually the first man to perish from what I've told. When I arrived, he had already passed. But Christopher Snyder was actually killed just about 2 weeks prior to the Boston Massacre. And unfortunately, I did respond to his passing as well. That particular event and subsequently what was now known as the Boston Massacre, I think it really changed my perception of what was happening. We had had town meetings, we had had deliberations, we had written letters, we had gone back and forth in newspapers against each other. Loyalists would write letters under pen names and we would do the same. We would talk about each other's grievances or defame each other in some way, shape, or form, even by accident. In New York, there was a conflict called the Battle of Golden Hill. Now, we're not even sure if anyone even perished in this battle. As the story goes, I believe that a regiment of the British Army came upon the citizenry. A conflict had just occurred with another citizen, or someone was being arrested, and the regiment decided to clear their way through the crowd and injured several citizens, and apparently one perished, but no one can confirm this. So,
nobody noticed was missing?
No one can be directly linked to dying because of an injury by the British Army.
I see.
And so word reaches Boston. We've already been in a tense state because the Quartering Act, speaking of acts passed by the House of Commons that inflict oppression upon Massachusetts Bay,
sure.
The Quartering Act allowed British soldiers to be able to be housed anywhere they pleased, basically. So a Boston family would have to take in a soldier, and then that soldier, because the British Army doesn't pay anything, they would take jobs away from Bostonians and work in the shipyards or do manual labors that other people that were actually from Boston could perform. And then this Battle of Golden Hill in New York happened. Some people that I know, Sir William Molyneux, who's actually no longer with us, as well as Ebenezer McIntosh, decided to lead a group of younger protesters to protest the home of Theophilus Lilly, who was by and large a more so bipartisan man, even up to this point. Many of his grievances that he stated were actually fairly correct in terms of how could we expect him to not trade British goods, which would bankrupt him, basically. And his arguments were sound, but the protesters decided to protest outside of his home. And unfortunately, fast forward and things got out of hand, and the man who ended up coming to Theophilus Lilly's aid was a not well-liked man in this town, that's for sure. He's still not. Was chased into his home and fired his blunderbuss out of his window and to the crowd, and some of the pellets hit another young man in the hip, and then majority of the shot landed into Christopher Sider's chest. Some have publicized that this young boy died instantly, and I wish that were the case. It spared him so many hours of suffering, but the bullet that he received, I couldn't lodge from his chest, and he gave his very manly farewells to his sister and his mother, and then he was gone. And In the days that followed, we had probably the largest funeral procession that I've ever seen for any citizen in town. In fact, I think John Adams would probably agree with me in that. Of course, citizens were not happy about it, and riots were in the streets. I believe one soldier and one citizen even fist-fought each other for a total of 3 days, and yes, I'm not saying that incorrectly. Imagine three grown men fighting for 3 days, just throwing fists at each other, taking breaks, and then restarting the entire conflict again.
That is really hard to imagine.
Both of them were so badly beaten, they had to be carried off from where they were fighting at. But these conflicts between the soldiery and the citizens was growing at an alarmingly scary rate. It just the fear and just what could happen next, and then the Boston Massacre. So, I mean, Christopher Sider's death really kind of drove the events that happened just a couple weeks later, roughly.
It was just another thing that kept pushing things forward, wasn't it?
I guess it hurt more because it was such a young life. And
yeah.
Unfortunately, what we used to do was, because market days were no young men were in school, so the younger men that were willing to protest with us and some of the more Whig-leaning peoples were invited to join us, and it just so happened that day that many a young person was present in these protests, and the two people that ended up being wounded from the blunderbuss being shot out of the window were two young boys.
You've listed so many different reasons for the colonists to rise up and revolt and decide we don't need England anymore. I mean, you just could go on. There's so many reasons that anybody could go from being a loyalist and say, that's it, I've had enough. We need to make our own country. It's no wonder that what is happening right now. But I guess what I'm wondering is, what was the most important first spark?
I think the most important spark, or at least the most distinguished spark, was definitely James Otis' speech against the resistance. Some of the points that he made that day not only propelled him to become a celebrity throughout the colonies, but really gave us the inspiration that we didn't need to be silent about this anymore. We didn't We didn't need to just serve. As I mentioned, we had just served in a war in the colonies, in supplying soldiers and mustering men. I myself mustered a regiment of my fellow classmates. We were not but 17, 18 years old. And we were here ready to go and march off to Canada to
that
fight for our mother country.
At Harvard?
This was my senior year at Harvard. So this is fall of 1758, I believe.
And you were ready to go fight somewhere?
Yeah, but I mean, we were my brothers and I were taught to shoot by our father. We were taught to be fairly sufficient and feel the land and cultivate and hunt and do things for ourselves. So we were fairly self-sufficient young men. I at least gained enough popularity amongst my friends to convince them to go serve in a war miles away. And thankfully, through the successful victories of the British Army in Canada, we never had to leave home. But several of our countrymen, several of the colonists from Massachusetts Bay made up the British Army that was fighting in Canada. Something like that, to have to form your own regiments and muster your own troops and fight for yourselves and fight for your country was not something that was out of reach for us or out of question. We were willing.
One could argue if you did that when you were 18, were you just looking for a fight at some point?
Some have argued that I've always looked for a fight. I remember that when people didn't appreciate some of the letters that I wrote under a pen name, this was probably 7 years ago in 1768, several of us had written some letters and we were publishing them, and the Tories would also publish their letters and, you know, try to counteract what we were saying. We'd go back and forth and so much, and I remember a soldier challenged me after I witnessed this man manhandling a innocent woman for no reason. And I didn't appreciate the way he was speaking or acting towards her, so I confronted him. And he decided to try to push me, and then I shoved him to the ground. For some reason, this became part of local lore that someone could just refuse the actions of a soldier, that he was untouchable because of the colors that he wore. And I was taken aback by the fact of his arrogance. And so I shoved him to the ground. And in fact, I believe he landed in some horse manure, which made it even better. And just imagine his bright red coat and his white pants, all just covered up in muck. And his superior officer came. And it just so happened that that officer was actually a member of our Freemasonry Lodge. So this soldier tried complaining, and he's just like, did you just really start a fight with Dr. Warren? How dare you? And I'm not sure what punishment he received, but it felt kind of good to know someone in the British Army and have those friendly connections. As I mentioned, these connections between us, we are brothers and sisters and neighbors and friends and family that are now being torn apart by a conflict that didn't need to happen. And any of our speeches, if any of our town meetings and newspaper edits and just our actions were taken into account, they would see, like you said, that some of our pleas are falling on deaf ears.
I can see that. I guess what I'm wondering is, here you are, you've just had this battle on, you know, a couple months ago, and it sounds like there are more to come. If the colonists unite and decide that they are going to go all out, it's going to be liberty or nothing. If that happens, who's going to be the leader of the United Colonies? Who do you think that person would be?
Well, I believe the general that we are going to vote as the general of our army is going to be the Mr. George Washington from Virginia. He has experience with the British Army. He was a colonel under General Braddock during the Seven Years' War, a fairly influential man, and I think that he is the proper choice with the proper experience. In terms of who leads this country, I'm not sure I can look forward that much. We still hope to be a part of Great Britain if we can. Independence from Great Britain was not our aim in our actions. Despite what you may hear, our wish is that we may grow and increase in strength together. But if these tyrannous acts continue, then we will not die from the field of fight. And I hope that we have proven that. I can't even say that we can declare independence just as yet. However, I personally do feel, and maybe since it's safe to say, I keep trying to remind myself that no one from my town will hear this.
That's correct.
Is that correct? No,
you're correct.
No, okay, okay. I had joked with Samuel Adams just last August. This is months ago, mind you. And I joked with Samuel Adams in the letter, that it is the wishes of the western and rural counties of Massachusetts Bay to go back to our original charter of 1691. But some of us in the eastern counties, and I wrote to him, I believe I said internas, which means between us in Latin. Between us, we know that these connections cannot last and that we must sever ties with the mother country. I've explained all of these different occurrences of grievances and tyrannous acts by the British government. There is no possible road towards connection anymore. There's no reason, as we have proven time again, that we can self-govern, that we can be honorable in that regard as well, and we are prepared to do it. And that's why they do not like us forming a provincial congress. They do not like us forming a continental congress and each colony having its own congress. They don't want people to believe that, wow, these citizens, these ordinary people who most of them weren't born rightful British citizens could govern themselves on some distant land 3,000 miles away across the North Sea. It is inconceivable, unfortunately, to many a British citizen that a colonist could achieve this. But we are rightfully prepared. And I think people just need to realize that we have so sincerely tried. We have gone up into pulpits of our greatest meeting houses and told those governors and those people who serve the governors what our grievances are. We have carried out certain actions to show that we are not going to take this, and it's never reciprocated with any correction of the actions of which we despise. It's always, let's pass another act, let's pass another action that will hinder you, whereas they believe that they are doing the right thing by an empire. And personally speaking, I will be frank that I do not believe that these connections can continue. I have to say these things in speeches and in my letters to New York and Pennsylvania and Virginia and to Continental Congress, but we are very much alone here. We are luckily having the support of New Hampshire and Connecticut and Rhode Island and have brothers in arms. But we need those other colonies from South Carolina and North Carolina and the others to all fully step into the fold. If we had militiamen from the other colonies, despite, you know, outside of the four that are now involved with us here in Cambridge, we would win decisively. There would be no war, but we don't receive any relief anymore. People are either refusing to send us supplies or are not getting our communications to at all donate to the cause. And the deliberations in the Continental Congress, I know, are frustrating my friends, Mr. John Adams and Samuel Adams and John Hancock and so many more. We just need to recognize we are strong enough.
You have just cleared something up for me, I think. There is no way to reconcile, and that these are going to be two countries, and that's just the end of it. But it's my understanding that you gave a speech just 2 months ago where you had said that you wanted the English and the colonists to be like oak and ivory, growing together and making one another stronger.
I believe it was oak and ivy growing together. But yes, I believe the connection should grow and increase in strength together. I believe with the colonies, Great Britain's influence and their strength in the world will only be continuously prosperous for generations to come. But that was in March of this year. And since then, we have had the battle of which you know as Lexington and Concord. We have had the siege of Boston. And we've had several citizens displaced from their homes, held as hostages, as I referred to them as bargaining chips. Since Jeez. Then, we've had the Battle of Chelsea Creek, which saw us burn a warship. Despite our momentary glee, we knew what that signal meant. Right. And as we speak, as I mentioned, soldiers are marching in preparation to fortify another hill outside of Boston on our end. And Lord only knows what they are preparing. And I do sense a great battle ahead of us. Where that battle will go and bring us, I do not know, but I will predict that any olive branch that is extended to King George III or his ministry of the House of Commons, the House of Lords, all will reject that olive branch from the Continental Congress.
Yeah.
They will deem us as seditious traitors. They will not be willing to hear anymore, especially if another great battle is had on in our country.
Why is it that you end up on the battlefield with a gun or stealing a cannon or burning a ship? You're a doctor. You are a trained, intelligent, skilled surgeon, I think, as well, from my understanding. Don't you think that maybe you shouldn't be the guy that musket balls are flying by? My understanding is that near Lexington and Concord, when that happened, a musket ball flew right by you. Why are you on the battlefield? Is that where you belong?
I believe that if anyone is determined to stand up for what is they believe to be morally righteous, and hopefully their center is centered, I hope that they also come to the realization that they can no longer witness suffering of multiple classes of people. I have served as a doctor to the highest of gentlemen in our society, and I have also treated those that are enslaved. I have come to know the great Phyllis Wheatley, whose name you may know is not only the first black author of her kind, but the first female author to have her poetry published. She is young and smart and brave, and the things that she says are cunning and forthright. For me, I would refer people to the teachings of John Locke. In his publication, The Second Treatise of Government, he states in Clause 43 that it is our right to make an appeal to heaven. If all other actions, if all other deliberations and all other efforts become unfruitful, I think we have the right to make that final appeal. And I was willing to appeal to heaven on April 19th. And yes, musket ball whizzed right by my head. I thought I had died, quite frankly, only to have General William Heath rise above me and just laugh, and laugh at the fact that it was the hairpin of my wig that saved me, that this musket ball struck the pin. I am not sure that any more sign could tell you that your path is correct if something so small, something so forgetful as a hairpin can save your life, to have you continue on, even if it's just months, even days, that I was on the right path. But my path is to serve with my friends and fellow citizens, no matter what rank of people they consider themselves to be. And yeah, we have quite ourselves a united front here in the provincial camp. And I think the Continental Congress can learn something by coming here, if they wish, finally, to witness some of the friendships that we have here in Cambridge, here in the Siege of Boston. I think that they could take these lessons of mutual friendship and allyship and take that with them to do something within the Continental Congress.
I think I just learned something about you that I don't know if you can read this in a book, but you were just mentioning just a second ago this first black woman author. As you were speaking, I could almost hear like reverence in your voice. That was something that you admired, that she would be the first. And there was a time earlier in this call when I had mentioned that a citizen in Britain could be a trash collector. And when I said that, you had a really strong reaction, that a trash collector is not less valuable than a writer, is not less valuable than a doctor. I mean, I could tell that you had a strong reaction. And it seems to me that it is no wonder that you are on the front lines of this and that you have to be involved, maybe even, well, definitely even risk your life. Because it seems to me that this concept of a merit-based society and just general fairness and decency, it seems like these are the cores of what seems like your personality. I can see why people follow you. My understanding is you were just promoted to general a couple days ago. Is that correct?
Well, yes. So the rest of the war council that we have formed here actually wished for me to take a surgeon's general's appointment, but I refuse to be kept off of the front lines, even if it means sacrificing my title as the president of the Provincial Congress in Massachusetts. You should expect more action. I hope it lasts longer than some may anticipate. them horribly reject the idea of me even being on the field of fight, especially now, considering I am the president of the Congress. But I don't see myself outside of the ranks of fighting with, my friends, my fellow citizens. And how could I arrive and speak in a pulpit about willing to sacrifice fortune and life and keep myself from the field of fight? I could not live with myself if I stayed at home in safety while my friends and fellow citizens were shedding their blood and hazarding their lives in the cause. To me, any self-respecting general should serve with his men. Even if that means his death, at least his death would be honorable. And I'd rather die on the field than be marched to the gallows.
That's why you feel like you have to be on the battlefield, because you have, and the people in Massachusetts have, the colonists have, what the British regulars don't have, and that is, they're just numbers. They're just send 50 troops over there, and for you, it's, I need three of my brothers, my uncle, and my neighbor, and my dentist, and you guys are fighting side by side, and that's what they're missing.
They are missing that. In our time, we refer to an ancient saying, which is a precious maxim for any society to live by. The phrasing is in Latin, Salus populi suprema exto, which means the will of the people be the highest law. And that is something that we have in mind that the British Army hasn't. And as they impress people, as they force people to fight for them and aren't able even to pay their troops to fight for them, we have the will of the people.
Very interesting. Let me ask you where you are right now.
Right now, I am in Cambridge. I room with a young man by the name of Elbridge Gerry. He is a young man who has actually made the name for himself here in the Provincial Congress, and I think he will go on to do many great things as a politician. He is as a very like mind, however, he has not served in any military aspect as of yet. I have tried to convince him to march on the field to fight with me, but he has yet to join, so hopefully that will change. But it is quite late in the evening now, and I expect I will probably be bothered for some more counsel or advice pretty soon.
Eldridge Gerry, by the way, I will tell you this, his name does become very famous for a specific reason that if I told you right now, it wouldn't make any sense at all. But his name is a name that probably half the people of our time know his name for a reason. He becomes well known, I'll tell you that.
As I hear your laughter as you say that, I'm sure it's maybe something more nefarious than I had hoped.
It's not great, we'll say that, but it isn't because of something that he did.
Does he at least have a great career before that happens?
Unfortunately, I don't know anything about his life. I just know his name. You know significantly more than I know, but who knows? Maybe I'll end up talking with him one day.
Very good.
You've been so generous with your time. I'm going to ask you two more questions if I can. Can you tell me what John Hancock was like? I know he was a friend of yours.
The Mr. John Hancock is elegant, cunning, intelligent, abrasive, mischievous even in some aspects, but of great mind and a solid heart. He is one of my dear friends, and as I said, it is probably to the annoyance of Samuel Adams that he has risen to become the president of the Continental Congress. I don't know if you know this about Samuel Adams, but he's actually referred to as the last Puritan of Massachusetts Bay, particularly because he comes off as a grumbling old goat most of the time. But yes, he is by and large probably the last Puritan here in this colony. But John Hancock is interesting, captivating, cunning, and again, mischievous because he knows he's great with words and you want to believe him. And sometimes he's lying to you and you know it, but you let it pass anyway. He's one of those friends.
Can he be trusted?
He can be trusted. He wouldn't lie about anything far too great, especially when I first met him. He's quite the prankster, actually. And I feel as if he had a little bit of fun when he first earned his fortune from his uncle. And he took some, no pun intended, some liberties with using that influence to prank some of us. But again, a great mind, and yes, he can be trusted.
All right, my last question. When you were standing with Paul Revere and William Dawes, and there was that moment where you needed to send them off to inform Sam Adams and John Hancock that the British were coming for them. What did you say to him?
Myself and my apprentice, the Mr. William Eustace, who also will probably go on to achieve great things in his life, I admire him almost as much as one of my sons. We actually witnessed the troops forming on the Boston Common together, and I alerted him to go fetch William Dawes and tell Mr. Dawes to go to my home, and then from there go to Mr. Revere's home and do the same. So Mr. Dawes actually left first, and him and Mr. Revere did not cross paths that night. As Mr. Dawes was in, I explained to him that we need to raise an alarm again, and this time it's definitely happening. The event that we have feared, the British Army marching on the countryside, it's going to happen, and we are sure of it. We had been alerted actually a few times prior to the night of April 18th that British troops might be excursioning onto the countryside. And as Mr. Dawes used to do, Mr. Dawes has a home in the countryside, and so, or a relative, I should say. What Mr. Dawes has come up with to get past the guards at the Boston Neck is that he acts inebriated, and that he needs to go to his relative's house in the countryside before curfew closes. So the British troops say, well, there's the non-sober William Dawes again, that's in past. So William Dawes put on his best show and made off into the night. And after he had left my home, it wasn't a short time later that Paul Revere arrived. And when I looked at Paul, he said, this is it. And I said, yes, it is, my dear friend. And honestly, we just hugged each other and wished each other well. And I told him if he's fortunate enough, I'll see him on the battlefield the next day.
And that ride was history after that.
Yes, since you know about this, it seems so.
Dr. Warren, I am so thankful for your contribution to everything that comes next. You might want to finish that brandy because you have a busy day ahead of you. And I will be wishing you the best during these tough times that are about to come.
Thank you, my dear sir, and thank you for sending me this interesting device. Please try to get others to use it.
I will definitely do that. Best wishes. Thank you.
If you live in New England, you might have already known who Joseph Warren was prior to this conversation. But all of those that know history know of his extraordinary contribution to our country. President Ronald Reagan invoked Joseph Warren at his first inaugural speech when he quoted Warren as saying, "Do not despair. On you depends the fortunes of America." After his death, Paul Revere named one of his children Joseph Warren Revere. Although Warren would not run from a fight, he was also a man of healing. Even when the world would have appeared to be on fire in the colonies, as the prospect of fighting the British seemed inevitable, Dr. Warren still held hope that there might be a resolution allowing Britain and America to be stronger together. He would have been an easy leader to follow and fight beside, because he understood the difference between just and unjust, as he held firm to his belief to let the will of the people be the highest law. Thank you for listening, and don't forget that when you subscribe and tell a friend about the Calling History podcast, you're making it possible for us to create more content. I'm Tony Dean, and until next time, I'm History.